This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Amnesty International's annual report on human rights set off a controversy that has yet to subside. After criticizing what it described as the Bush administration's effort to redefine torture, justify the use of coercive interrogation, hold so-called ghost detainees at undisclosed locations, and send others to countries known to practice torture, the report added, quote, "The detention facility at Guantanamo Bay has become the gulag of our times, entrenching the practice of arbitrary and indefinite detention in violation of international law," unquote. Administration officials, including President Bush, seized on the word gulag and described the comparison as absurd and reprehensible. The gulag was a system of prison camps in the Soviet Union set up by Joseph Stalin. Over decades, millions landed in prison camps where they were used as slave labor, many starved or froze to death. The U.S. currently holds over 500 men prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, many captured in Afghanistan as long as 3 years ago and held since then without charge or trial. Men who fought for al-Qaeda or the Taliban are considered unlawful combatants and thus not qualified for prisoner of war status under the Geneva Convention. We'll talk today about the validity and the wisdom of the Gulag charge and about the broader issue of human rights and the war on terror. Later in the program, historian Douglas Brinkley on the U.S. Army Rangers who stormed a cliff on D-Day 61 years ago today, and the president who incorporated their courage in a speech that changed politics and culture. But first, human rights in the post-9/11 world. If you have questions about the Gulag comparison, give us a call. But we'd also like to ask what you would do if you were in charge. Are there circumstances that justify holding exceptionally dangerous people without charge? Our number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. We'll hear two views today. We begin with William Schultz, the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. He joins us from our bureau in New York. And nice to have you back in the program, Bill.
Thank you, Neil.
Amnesty International has taken an awful lot of the heat for the use of that word gulag. In retrospect, was it a mistake?
I don't think so, Neil. The New York Times lead editorial yesterday dubbed it an apt metaphor. And I think that, at least in part, it certainly is. Amnesty International was never saying that this was a literal gulag in the same sense as the Soviet gulags. After all, we said gulag of our time. There certainly are differences between U.S. detention facilities and Soviet gulags, differences in size, differences in the sense that prisoners in U.S. facilities are not being starved to death or forced into labor, but there are also similarities. The U.S. is maintaining, as the Soviets did, an archipelago of prisons throughout this world. Many of them are secret. That was true of the gulags. And in those prisons, the U.S. is detaining people, disappearing them, without charge, without access to courts or to lawyers or to families, and in some cases at least, we now know that those prisoners are being mistreated, abused, tortured, and even killed. 27 of those detained by the United States have been ruled to be the victims of homicide by medical examiners. So in those senses, I think it is, as the New York Times says, an apt metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yet, as you point out, there are significant and important differences that have, well, I mean, just to name a few. I mean, the scale of this system, it's nothing approaching the Soviet system.
Nothing approaching. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. That's why it's the gulag of our time.
Mm-hmm. Why not Auschwitz?
Well, one could use any number of semantic references, but in fact, the International Secretary General of Amnesty, reflecting world opinion, and whether we Americans like it or not, this is, I'm afraid, how much of the world regards the United States, used the gulag comparison.
You use the gulag, but any outrageous comparison is okay by you?
Well, I say I don't think it's outrageous, and neither does the New York Times, Neil.
Okay, if you have the editorial support of the New York Times, I...
Well, at least there's... that would, I presume, make us think twice, wouldn't it?
It might make us think twice. Now, the U.S., another section of the report reads, the U.S. sets the tone for governmental behavior worldwide. Actually, let me get back to that issue just for a second. In a comparison which has so many differences between the gulag and what is being done in Guantanamo Bay and other places, though to be fair, I mean, you talked about an archipelago, the report only says Guantanamo Bay is the gulag of our times, but in any case, when there are so many differences, aren't you leaving it open to administration officials to say, well, that's ridiculous, the whole report's ridiculous?
Well, I don't think so. I think that the report has, in large measure, been judged on its merits. And I will say that we're very grateful to the president and his colleagues for giving this story legs. And I don't think I'd be on with you, Neil, talking about the substance of what's going on, not only in Guantanamo Bay, but in U.S. detention facilities around the world, if the Secretary General hadn't done this and if the president hadn't reacted as he and his colleagues did.
The U.S., your report, another section of the report says, the U.S. sets the tone for governmental behavior worldwide when the most powerful country in the world thumbs its nose at the rule of law and human rights. It grants a license to others to commit abuse with impunity and audacity. That accords the United States a leadership role on a lot of things and indirectly blames the U.S. for a lot of bad things elsewhere.
Well, I think the U.S. has accorded itself a leadership role when it comes to the promotion of democracy, when it comes to seeing itself as a champion of human rights. After all, the United States has always represented itself that way. And we know it's simply a fact. There's no debate here. Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe has quoted the United States as providing a model for what he is doing to his opponents in Zimbabwe. The Chinese have regularly cited the United States and its practices as an excuse for their prison camps. So there's no question but what the United States, whether meaning to or not, has provided cover, is providing cover. And look, the bottom line here is this war on terror, according to President Bush, eloquently stated often, is being fought in defense of human rights, in defense of the rule of law, in defense of freedom, and in promotion of democracy around the world. If that's the case, then the United States does establish itself as something of a benchmark, a plumb line against which other countries can measure themselves. And when the United States violates human rights, I think it does have a far more profound effect than when Cote d'Ivoire, for example, does so.
Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, and cited today by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, and others, is so what do you do with these people? These are, some of them, very dangerous people.
They may well be dangerous people. And look, Amnesty International is not calling for the release of these prisoners. Amnesty is saying something very simple. We are saying that the Geneva Conventions, the most respected human rights treaty in the world, of which the United States is a party, the Geneva Conventions require that a captor cannot unilaterally decide the status of a captive taken in the course of war. You said in the introduction here that these have been dubbed enemy combatants. That's exactly the point. They've been dubbed enemy combatants by the United States. But the conventions require that when there is any kind of dispute about the status of prisoners, that dispute has to go to what the conventions call a competent tribunal. That's never happened. And all that Amnesty International is saying is that you either have to bring these prisoners before a, quote, competent tribunal or not and determine their status. And if they're not prisoners of war, then you have to make a case against them. You have to take some kind of action. We know that more than 200 of these prisoners have already been released. That means that at least there's some reason to believe that though they were dubbed enemy combatants in the first place, and though Secretary Rumsfeld said when they were first transferred to Guantanamo they were, quote, the worst of the worst, so bad I think he said that they would bite your nose off. But indeed, at least 200 of them have reformed pretty quickly, I guess.
Though General Myers did say today that some of those released had returned to fight the United States on the battlefield, though he did not say how he knows that. In any case, we're talking about the Amnesty International's comparison of Guantanamo Bay to the Gulag and human rights in time of war on terrorism. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And Crystal is our first caller. Crystal calls from Metropolis, Illinois.
Yes, my main concern is if we consider these people to be very deadly criminals, dangerous criminals, why can't we find charges to bring against them? In that same sense that if they're criminals and they're acting as terrorists, wouldn't there be some sort of conspiracy that we have found in order to think them that way? And if there is, why haven't we charged them with conspiracy? Or if they've got bomb-making materials, why haven't we charged them with handling, you know, a dangerous substance? I just can't bring myself to believe that these people have been sitting here for years now with absolutely no charges.
Well, William Schultz, would evidence gathered at Guantanamo Bay be useful in a trial of any of those prisoners at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, of course, at this point, I suspect that any, quote, evidence, unquote, that's been gathered has been tainted by, first, the denial of the fundamental rights under the Geneva Convention, and second, at least some suspicion about how that evidence has been gathered. We know a few things about what's happened at Guantanamo Bay. We know from a Kentucky National Guardsman, for example, that prisoners have had their heads slammed into cell walls. We know from the Red Cross that they've been subjected to prolonged isolation. We know from FBI agents who were stationed at Guantanamo Bay that they've been held in stress positions for up to 24 hours. So obviously, it's difficult to say whether their evidence would ever be admissible in court at this point, given what the United States chose to do in the first place.
And how do we know those details?
I just cited their sources. The FBI, that was a story the New York Times broke through ACLU FOIA requests.
ACLU and FOIA, either of those things available to prisoners at the Gulag?
I don't understand your question.
Well, again, getting back to comparison to the Soviet Union, another issue where the United States is reporting on its own practices at Guantanamo Bay.
Certainly
that's how
through,
we know about this.
They're reporting it only because the ACLU forced them to report it, and the United States tried very hard to deny the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay access to lawyers in the first place. It took the intervention of the Supreme Court to make that happen, and even now it's not happening in any consistent way.
Crystal, would you say that if there were no usable evidence to be presented in a court of law, that the only thing to do then is to let the prisoners go?
Yes, I would say that. I think that the fact that they've been held for so long without finding anything to charge them with speaks towards their defense, to be quite honest.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. We're talking about the verbal war over conditions at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay and other U.S. facilities, and the larger issue of human rights and the war on terrorism. More with William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, after a short break. Also, we'll hear from David Rifkin, who served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and George Bush senior administrations. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the war of words between Amnesty International and the Bush administration. That after an Amnesty report described the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay as the gulag of our times. Our guest is William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Peter. Peter's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, hi there. I think my main point is that this is a different type of war than we fought in the past, and I really do think that the intelligence information gathering has been very useful. No doubt the 200 that were released were probably because some of them had given up some information that was very useful. So I just think that we can, you know, if we're talking about Gulag and Geneva Conventions, you know, it reminds me of, Berg being beheaded and some of the car bombs and so forth. The tactics just are a whole bit different than they were in previous wars. So I'm not advocating or saying that they are doing the right thing by torturing prisoners and so forth. But, I think really in the end, if we didn't have a place to capture and to put people like Guantanamo, I think a lot more GIs would just, there'd be a lot more casualties in the field also.
And William Schultz, the intelligence aspect is one thing that administration supporters come back to, that these people may have information about deeds yet to come.
Well, Neil, but we know from the Army Field Manual, we know from FBI manuals about interrogation, that in fact you can get a great deal of information far more productively without abusing or torturing people than you can by doing so. So I'm in no way opposed to obtaining intelligence information from people who may have information that could save lives. Of course, Amnesty is about protecting lives. There's no objection to that. The problem is that you can't go about it in the way that the United States appears to have done, and indeed that President Bush himself, like this caller, gave a green light to permit to do when in February 2002 he issued an executive order which said that we ought to conform to the Geneva Conventions in our treatment of detainees, quote, to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity. He gave a huge out, a big black hole through which military interrogators have more than happily moved.
The administration says it does not condone torture, and the use of that word is Amnesty's opinion and not the administration's.
The administration, Neils, makes a very interesting distinction between torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Yes, it repeatedly says that it doesn't condone torture. It has never been unequivocal in its statement that it doesn't condone what would be considered in many contexts cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment.
Peter, are you still worried about the
Yes, it's just, I don't know. I just don't think that we are fighting a war as we did in prior wars. There's something very unique about the circumstances here. And I do think if we did not have a method of detaining and gathering information, you know, maybe the torture part is overblown. I'm not sure how widespread that really is. But we need this intelligence. We do not have assets on the ground gathering intelligence information. This is really the only way. And ultimately, I think it's going to shorten the war and save lives, American lives.
Peter, thanks for the phone call. Bill Schultz, there are prisoners in Guantanamo. The great majority of them are from either Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or Yemen. Their organization...
Pakistan.
And Pakistan as well, yes. Their organization, though, is they're trans. It's just one of these transnational actors, Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban was certainly based in Afghanistan, though. Does that not present a difficult problem?
Well, it may indeed present a difficult practical problem, but it doesn't change the fact that the United States is a party to the conventions and is required to follow certain rules of law, particularly when you're fighting a war in defense of the rule of law. And it's very simple. You either declare these people prisoners of war, you can retain them till the end of the conflict then, or you charge them with a crime, if indeed they're guilty with a crime. Other than that, you've got to release them.
Bill Schultz, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. He joined us from our bureau in New York. With us here in Studio 3A in Washington is David Rivkin. He served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's now a lawyer in private practice here in Washington. David Rivkin, thanks very much for coming in today.
Nice to be with you.
What's your reaction to the use of that word gulag?
A negative one, and I've heard Mr. Schultz talk about it before. I would say the right thing to do would be to apologize. I think the comparison is absolutely outrageous. It weakens their credibility, and they're certainly a very venerable organization. There's absolutely no comparison. And the way
should be said, Amnesty International was vital in investigating cases of human rights abuses in the real gulag, the Soviet Union.
And the way, frankly, Mr. Schultz goes about it, well, it's not literal, it's metaphorical. To me, and I'll paraphrase Charles Krauthammer of the Washington Post, there's some terms like gulag, like Holocaust, that imbued with such distinctive, powerful, emotional, and historical meaning that you profane those terms and use them in less ways. But he's not saying it exactly literal. It's more of a metaphor. And what's his business about archipelago? Archipelago really means more than one. So if you have multiple prisons, you have archipelago prisons, does that make it a gulag? It's nonsense. I frankly think that they're spinning just as disingenuously as I think the Nixon administration was spinning on many occasions. The right thing to do for him would be to apologize and really talk about the substance here.
Well, archipelago also obviously summons the image of the Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great work about the Soviet prison system. Putting aside the word for the moment, what about the underlying issues? Hundreds of detainees being held have not been been formally charged with a crime, many not allowed to see a lawyer. All of them are denied the protections of the Geneva Convention. Is that appropriate?
It is entirely appropriate, and it's worth, and I'm glad you put it this way. Let's forget about abuses for a second. Let's talk about the basic legal paradigm. The basic legal paradigm in the Geneva Convention, as important as they are, by the way, is one set of documents in a long chain of documents and customary law that goes back to, certainly 19th century. What are the basic rules? Everybody involved in armed conflict is an enemy combatant. Once you capture an enemy combatant, the question is this: is this a lawful combatant? And whether or not you're lawful depends whether you comply with four or five basic criteria, of which the key one is, you have to structure your own conduct prior to capture in accordance with the laws and customs of war, because there's obviously a connection between how you behave prior to being captured with how well you're going to be treated after being captured, to provide an inducement to people to do the right thing. If you're not a lawful combatant, you're an unlawful enemy combatant, not a new category people somewhat disingenuously claim was invented by this administration. If you look at military manuals, if you look at the case law, it's been around for centuries again. Traditionally, unlawful enemy combatants were treated very harshly, killed out of hand, hung, shot, saboteurs, spies, totally lethal. The administration's legal position is this: if you are an unlawful enemy combatant, you are not entitled to Geneva protection privileges. The Geneva Convention does not deal with you. What you're entitled to is being treated humanely, which Mr. Schultz forgot to mention. The administration has said from the very beginning, publicly and privately, you're entitled to humane treatment, but no more than that. You're not entitled to the gold standard, if you will, associated with the Geneva Convention. Among other things, you can be interrogated humanely, but much more so than with POWs, where basically you cannot even offer a POW an inducement. All he has to give you, in all the films I've seen, rank, file, serial number, you cannot say to a POW, I'm going to give you apples, or I'm going to give you cigarettes if you give me additional information, because they have a privilege, they have a right to withhold that information. Unlawful combatants do not.
Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and let's go to Sherry. Sherry's with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy your program.
Thanks.
I've been reading about gulags and prison camps and stuff since I discovered them when I was about 10, when I was a little kid. And what concerns me about the government, our government's treatment of these prisoners is, first of all, how does a person label someone a terrorist? How we define someone, we're not even defining these people who were picked up.
I think, Sherry, we were just talking about the definition of them as unlawful combatants.
Oh, okay. I just missed that part while I was being
brought
on. The second comment I had was, what we do to others can be done to us.
And
if we feel it's fair to treat people by not letting them have contact with any family members, we don't identify them, we don't give them even basic humane treatment, as the treatment you were describing a little while earlier, hanging them for 24 hours in stress positions.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets were doing that, and after a while, the Soviet Union itself became the terrorists.
Yeah, but let me put that to David Rivkin. And clearly, there are abuses going on, and there is the broader question of, even if you have the right to do it, is it wise to do it?
I understand. Let me answer it two ways. First of all, let's leave abuses aside. I think the caller, while well-intentioned, misses a fundamental point. Even POWs, who are lawful combatants, never, ever in human history, I mean, look at Hogan's Heroes. We want to use pop culture, but pop culture often tracks the reality. Never got access to lawyers. Never got specific charges. The idea basically is to make sure, forgetting even interrogation imperatives, that you don't return back to combat. So you're basically warehoused, not indefinitely, not forever, but for a number of years, if that's how long it takes to finish the conflict. And that's lawful combatants. So the notion, and this is a problem fundamentally with a paradigm that Amnesty International advances. You may have noticed, Mr. Schultz said, you're either a POW or you're a terrorist, in which you have to be charged criminally. They are not acknowledging that there is a third category which has been with us for centuries. You're an enemy, unlawful enemy combatant who is never a POW. You're a criminal, to be sure. But very important for your listeners to understand that. It is virtually, remember OJ trial, given the requirements in American courts in terms of chain of custody of evidence, in terms of contamination, in terms of all those things, it is virtually impossible to prosecute criminally anybody picked on a battlefield in Afghanistan or Pakistan. Any good defense attorney would get him off. even if you bring into court the very person who captured him, and let's say this person is not on another combat assignment or hasn't been killed, even if you do that, it just doesn't work. I mean, all you need to do is to look at the news about how difficult it is to convict anybody. The criminal justice model doesn't work. And these people never, even POWs, never had access to lawyers, never were able to go to courts. All you get is a little smidgen of due process in case of doubt under Article 5. And I emphasize the predicate for it, in case of doubt. Now, when there's no doubt, you don't get any process.
Now, the Supreme Court has disagreed with the administration about that and said that, indeed, there has to be some process.
The Supreme Court has said that, and again, this is a great, unique thing about this country, but we're governed by laws and not men. The Supreme Court said it not as a matter of international law, as a matter of American constitutional law. So these individuals are getting more due process than anybody has ever gotten in the history of warfare. But we're talking about Geneva Convention. The problem with Amnesty's approach, they fundamentally misstate Geneva Conventions. For example, Mr. Schultz, and I had to pick up on him, said, it is not up to us to judge who they are. What are you talking about? In Geneva Convention, it is the detaining power that decides whether or not there is doubt, decides who is an enemy combatant, decides who is a combatant tribunal. It's not Amnesty International or some world court. There's absolutely no basis for making those claims.
Mm-hmm. Sherry, would it concern you if in fact it did prove difficult to prove any of these criminal charges in an American court?
I'm not sure, because I think we're hurting our own cause by the manner by which we're treating them. It seems as though we're treating international law with indifference, and we're just saying we're going to ship them wherever we please and let other governments torture them.
We're not
torturing them ourselves. And I think by torturing people, we are ruining by public relations, if nothing else other than humanity. I think by the PR that we're using in these cases is just terrible, let alone our inhumanity toward people. It used to be people wanted to be captured by the Americans. Look at Saddam Hussein's troops in the first Gulf War. Now, everybody's terrified if they're captured by American troops. Think about the difference in the two wars.
Sherry, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about human rights, Guantanamo Bay, and gulags. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest is David Rivkin, now a partner in the law office of Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C., served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Let's get another caller on the line. This is James. James with us from Muskegon, Michigan.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to speak with you.
Hi.
This seizure on the word gulag seems to be an effort of smoke and mirrors by the administration to discredit this report totally.
Wasn't the administration's word?
No, but they have just seized on this word, and everybody seems to be talking about gulag all the time rather than the actual substance of the report, which is about the abuses in the prison system itself.
Well, one of the reasons is because gulag is a pretty serious charge.
It is a serious charge, and it seems to have had its desired effect. At least it has brought this report to the surface, and is giving a lot more airtime to it than it would have gotten otherwise. The other thing is, the Bush administration used an Amnesty International report to justify this war in Iraq in the first place.
Amnesty International's account of human rights abuses by the Saddam Hussein regime?
Right. And now there's one against the Bush administration, or the U.S. administration at the moment, for treatment of prisoners or people captured. We don't know whether they're actually legitimate prisoners or not.
Mm-hmm.
Has the Bush administration in any way kind of backed down and said, yeah, maybe not?
I don't believe they've changed their tune, James, at least not on the basis of this report.
No, I couldn't see them doing that. They haven't changed their tune on anything at any time.
David Rivkin, let me ask you also, thanks for the call, James. Let me ask you again, we talked about the legality. In your mind, this is perfectly legal. Abuses aside, you say they're individual cases and that the system itself is humane. But is it wise, getting back to Sherry's call, this has become, between Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, it's become a recruiting poster for the other side. Is it wise to maintain this system, given the politics of this time?
I understand. By the way, Neil, with all due respect, I don't want to accept the proposition that it is much of a recruiting poster. I happen to think, if you look at events in Iraq, for example, you have entities and organizations that are fundamentally fighting against freedom, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to impose a theocratic, genocidal regime that basically cannot flourish, cannot survive.
And accounts of flushing the Quran down the toilet? Disproved, but those accounts don't help them?
It's, you know, you always in law look for but for how much of an increment it is. But you're asking a very good question. Look, the problem of the critics, my problem of Amnesty International is not, repeat, not that they're commenting on some abuses, which have occurred. Incidentally, my position, I think the administration's position, abuses have been rare, very important for your listeners to appreciate. Fewer abuses per number of people captured than in any other human history. The problem you have is that the critics don't want just to fix that. They want to fundamentally flush down, get rid of the system and treat people as criminal defendants, in which case it would completely be broken.
David Rifkin, thanks very much for being with us today. David Rifkin from the Reagan and first Bush administrations, now with Baker and Hostetler. When we come back, D-Day, 61 years later, this is NPR News.